This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Even before the murder of DCF staffer Lara Sobel last Friday, the job that social workers do has come under fire. Speaking yesterday on Vermont Edition, Ken Schatz, the commissioner of the Department for Children and Families, said he's disturbed by hateful, threatening, and degrading comments he's seen crop up in responses to published stories about DCF social workers.
The concern is that, first of all, that they indicate a lack of understanding and respect for the role of social workers, that and moreover, that when you see these kind of hateful comments, it makes our social workers feel uncomfortable and insecure in terms of their safety, and we just need to recognize that and talk about how we can address that narrative so that we give social workers the respect that they deserve.
Commissioner Schatz says social workers are doing a task that we ask them to do to protect our children, and he'd like to see the rhetoric change.
We need to support our social workers. We ask them to do an incredibly challenging task. They're professional, they're dedicated, they're committed. Every day they take on incredibly challenging situations involving children and families. They do their best to protect children and to work through those situations in a respectful manner. And in due course, they deserve respect.
But even people who do look at social workers with respect may not fully understand what the job entails. There are social workers in many areas, not just at the Department for Children and Families. And today on Vermont Edition, we're going to learn a little bit more about the training social workers get, what their jobs entail, and how much security and safety are a concern. We're joined for this discussion by Gary Widrick. He's the former chair of the Social Work Department at the University of Vermont, and he's former director of the grant that gives students training for work in child welfare. Gary Widrick, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Jane.
Can you just start by maybe explaining a little bit what kind of training social workers do get?
Well, I will talk primarily about the training that the University of Vermont has been contracted with the State Department of Children and Families to do. And before I start, I want to express my sincere condolences to the family of Lara Sobel and to the other individuals in Barrie that were tragically killed. It was a horrible circumstance, and I want to just express my sorrow about that, and also on behalf of the Department of Social Work. The training that we have done over the years has been actually done through a federal grant. And the federal government over the last 20 or 30 years has been very, very concerned about the performance at child welfare offices across the country, and also in making sure child welfare staff have the best training and skills to do the job. I want to say right off the bat that this is a very complex, difficult, trying job. There's also a lot of satisfaction in this job as well. And I'll talk from the research that I've done with child welfare workers directly and get their thoughts on that. But I also want to let you know that I was a child welfare worker many years ago in upstate New York in the early 1970s. And I experienced some of the things. I certainly didn't experience the horrible tragedy we had here, but I did hear of threats that my colleagues had, and I did know of some dangerous situations. But basically the training – I want to go back to the training. The training the federal government has been promoting over the years is to ensure that social workers, both at DCF and those coming into the program of social work at the Department of Social Work at UVM, have the opportunity to have an experience in which they will learn not only social work skills, which are terribly important in this job, but also how to work within a public child welfare environment. And so we have an opportunity for some students. We have roughly 50 first-year MSW students who come into our program every year. And about
so those are master's degree
candidates. For their master's degrees. Mm-hmm. And we also have some in the undergraduate program, which is a bachelor's degree in social work, who apply for and if they're accepted are brought into the what's called the Title IV program. That's a two-year program and includes field placements in actual DCF offices so that the social workers get to see firsthand, the prospective social workers get to see firsthand what is the work like and what are they going to have to be doing. And they combine that with classroom learning related to human behavior, related to how to practice and work with clients and how to develop relationships with clients, research, which I taught was one of the least favorite subjects, but they still got that, and policy and other things. And so they were very well prepared when they went out. Now, we also – the other part of the grant was a that my colleagues did at the Department of Social Work and still do. We still have a grant from the Department of Health and Human Services through the Department of Children and Families in Vermont. And by the way, I want to say our partners at the Department of Children and Families are superlative in how well they collaborate and coordinate with us. And just as an aside, I talked to other deans and directors of social work across the country, and most don't have a relationship with their state agencies as well as we do here in Vermont. So I do want to throw those superlatives to the state because I think they do a good job in coordinating with us. But the other part of the training grant, in addition to training our prospective MSW students, is to go out into DCF offices on a regular basis and work with social workers, whether they've been through our program or not, to begin to understand how to work with families, how to work in difficult situations, how to identify if the child is safe or not, and because the highest priority is the safety of the child and what's in the best interests of the child. Another priority is to make sure if we can make it work within the biological family to try to do that. But there are some instances when children have to be taken into custody. And social workers have to have the skills to be able to, if you will, diagnose and assess that. So we provide a whole plethora of training both for the students in our program and for the DCF workers who are in all of the district offices across Vermont. And that's an ongoing thing that's been happening since 1993. And the federal government has really helped and stepped up and supported that. Now, the one downside is we can't offer the social work part of that to everybody. There's only about 8 or 9 slots we can offer. And that allows the student to get tuition assistance, a stipend, and to be hired right after they're out of they graduate. They'll be hired within days by the Department of Children and Families, and they'll be on the job. And that's so not everybody can access that because we have limited funding in that. But I just wanted to just quickly give you some statistics. I know statistics bores people, but
well, let me stop you there. Okay. So, and we'll get into that because I want to get into statistics.
Sure.
But I also want to invite our listeners. We know that this is a question that's come up for people. What do social workers do? And we know that there are also among our listeners many of you who have some experience in this field or have some understanding of what we're talking about today. And so I'd love to invite you to share your thoughts, share your own experience as a social worker, or if you have a question for our guest today, Gary Widrick. He's former chair of the social work department at the University of Vermont. We'd love to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your comments or questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Okay, so before we get into some of the statistics you wanted to cite, let me ask you, you mentioned that social workers are trained in how to assess when a child is in danger, when a child might need to be taken out of a home, or when it's safe to work with a family and try to preserve that family structure and integrity. So how do social work students get that training? What are they actually trained to see and to understand?
Okay. And I just want to also make sure people understand it's part of a court process. The social workers, and this is important for the people who seem to be criticizing social workers are part of a team that includes the family court, that includes state's attorneys, that includes our legislators who make the laws that relate to child welfare and to the federal government that puts down the standards and policies. Social workers are part of a larger system. And I think we have to understand that system, understand what the where the responsibilities lie. And ultimately, it's a family court decision whether to take or terminate parental rights or to take the child. So we always have to keep that in mind, that some people think social workers have much more power and we would really like to have, but we don't have that much power. So, you know, how are they trained? Well, I mentioned before, first way would be in the classroom for our students who are in our MSW program, and also in what we call field placements, where for a whole year, for over 400 hours a year, students are actually in a DCF office working side by side with child welfare workers and being supervised by an MSW with experience. Who has worked in the public child welfare system.
And just to recap again, an MSW is a person with a master's in social work.
That's a master's in social work. There's also a degree, a bachelor's in social work. These are accredited degrees at our university. And they allow you to work not only – I want to emphasize that social workers do much more than public child welfare. They
That's
work
right.
in mental health. They work in healthcare. They work with the homeless, with the elderly, with victims of domestic violence in schools. So social workers have a wide variety of possible positions. So, but the public child welfare arena is so critical important because I think we all know that what happens to our children is vitally important to not only to them but to us, you know, in terms of what type of society we want to live in. So we really want to take an interest in how kids develop and thrive, or if they don't, to be able to hopefully intervene in some way that will help families to be able to rectify that.
So is that what they're looking for? Are they looking for signs and developmental signs in the children? Are they looking at what's mm-hmm. happening in a home, mm-hmm. what they can see? Are mm-hmm. they looking at the interactions mm-hmm. between parents and children?
Yes. In some cases, it's very – the indicators are very gross. Let's say a pediatrician finds a broken bone or the harm. Or that's definite. And that has to be looked at immediately and intervention immediately. But in many other cases, in the vast majority of cases, it might be neglect. Maybe it's a single mom in the home and she happens to step out for a couple of hours to go shopping or work somewhere. And somebody calls in and says these kids are not being taken care of. Or a school teacher says, I don't think Johnny or Jane are progressing as well as they should through school, and I think the parents are neglecting their educational development. Or, as I say, a neighbor or someone happens to see inappropriate punishment, physical punishment or whatever that puts the child in danger. So those are the types of things that are reported, and then the social worker has to come out and do a home visit. And I, as a social worker, did that. I did it mainly with older youngsters, but you go out and you start to find out what happened. And one of the key parts of this, Jane, and I think our listeners have to understand this, is it's the relationship that the social worker makes with the family that begins to start a conversation and a discussion and a dialogue and hopefully develops the trust that's so necessary. One time I had somebody ask me, they said, oh, a public child welfare person is just a cop without a gun, right? And I said, no, it's not a law enforcement. I mean, there are aspects of child welfare that are law enforcement, but basically what social workers are in there to do is to find out from the people themselves and to understand what is going on. And to be able to work with people in a cooperative way and develop a relationship. And we now know from – I was just at a week-long conference on neuroscience. We now know how important social engagement relationships are and how the cognitive systems and the physical and psychological systems of our body can be regulated, and we can be able to even deal with trauma. I mean, many of these situations are social workers go into the home. We're dealing with not only trauma that could be affecting the children, but trauma that has affected the parents. So the social workers have to be well armed with all of the tools that are necessary to be able to make good assessments, good diagnostics of the situation, and then possibly to refer to others, because the social workers will not be able to continue to carry the case clinically. They will have to refer out to other providers in the community, but keep track of what goes on in those interactions. So it's that's what I said earlier. It's a complex situation of what social – they need to have an understanding and training before they even do that first home visit, in my view. I didn't have the benefit of an MSW degree or training or anything before I began my work, and I made many mistakes. And I remember the faces of the children that I made mistakes with. And, you know, we just can't make mistakes. We have to really work together. And the good thing now now about child welfare is a team approach. It's not just one social worker trying to figure it all out. We're really invested more and more in how to help folks work as team together. So it's a shared responsibility. And also the supervision the social worker gets is a key component. It should be high quality supervision. And we also train folks on that too through our training program at UVM. So we're aware of a lot of the different aspects here. The one issue that has really been always overwhelming in child welfare is the number of cases. And from the data that I did a research project on the folks that went through the Title IV-E program and got did some qualitative interviews with folks, and I found out that many of them are just overwhelmed by the number of cases and especially the paperwork. And they also told me they had problems with the technology of reporting it, the case notes and the case plans and everything. I think we have to do a better job. This is not a direct criticism of anyone in the state here. But I think we have to do a much better job in helping to support the social workers back in the home offices so that – and also in the communities to be able to do their work in a professional way.
We're talking with Gary Widrick. He's the former director of the social work department, former chair of the social work department at the University of Vermont. And we're hearing from some of you as well who have some experience with social work. You can ask a question by calling 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page. Bob is a child psychologist in southwestern Vermont, and he writes, "My path working in mental health has involved developmental disability institutions, psychiatric hospitals, community mental health, crisis stabilization programs, residential treatment for sex offenders, Head Start, and medical hospitals. I have been threatened, attacked, hit, kicked, punched, had to tackle kids trying to run away, and my family has been threatened directly and by mail. Not only do you have to tolerate most of this, then you have to put your emotions on hold because there's another child and family needing help, your next case. The current mental health crisis is a complex animal, driven by many issues including healthcare economics, social media, lack of resources, lack of training, and lack of support for people out in the field. I have done scary home visits in dangerous neighborhoods, and most of these visits were done alone. Bob says, my heart and best wishes go out to the family of Mrs. Sobel, and I support reforms and increased resources, especially for my friends and colleagues at the Bennington DCF office and social welfare organizations nationwide. And Sarah notes, this highlights the environment of scarce resources in which social workers do their work. Caseloads for DCF employees consistently far exceed nationally accepted best practices, despite the department's best efforts to hire additional staff. Social workers are a distinct profession with a national structure for educational standards and codes of conduct. It has been wonderful to hear so many statewide officials lauding the excellent work of DCF employees in recent days. What social workers need are sufficient resources to do their work, and for statewide leaders to illustrate their respect for the profession by dedicating tangible resources to their efforts. More to come here as we talk more about the profession of social work. Your thoughts and insights are welcome. Again, go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page to post a comment or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking today with Gary Widrick, who used to chair the social work department at the University of Vermont. He's helping us understand the unique challenges of the profession and answering questions about the kind of training Vermont social workers get. If you have one of those questions or if you'd like to share your own perspective, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or please add to the conversation on the Vermont Edition page at VPR.net. Sandra is calling in from Burlington. Hi, Sandra. Go ahead.
Hi there. I was a social worker in another state for several years, and I just want to give credit to all of those who do this job every day. I personally could only last a couple of years because the reality is that social workers and those that work with children and families in troubled situations often see sometimes the worst of humanity, and that takes a real toll, whether you are dealing with your own personal life or, you know, the loved ones around you. And I would like to agree with the other person that wrote in that, you know, the best way for state officials to show their respect and show their praise is to continue to reward them, to cut down on the amount of cases that each worker is responsible for, and improve safety measures, because it really, really is scary. And social workers don't really get what we call hazard pay. So want to thank you for having this really important program today.
Sandra, thanks for your call and your perspective. I appreciate it. Let's go to Richard, who's calling in from Carroll, New Hampshire. Hi, Richard. Your thoughts today?
Yes, I'm just going to echo what the previous caller said. I'm a father and a father-in-law to two social workers. They're both in their 40s, and they started off, like most people that go into social work, with wanting to do good for others. And the problem is that they see the generational successional problems of problem families, and they feel like they can't solve the problems, and it goes on and on and on. And they do carry that home with them, and it's a very difficult situation. And they're to be cherished as people who are very difficult to find. And that's it.
Richard, thanks for your call, and best of luck to your daughter and your daughter-in-law. And one more here. Jeff is calling in from Springfield. Hi, Jeff. Go right ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
I'm just curious. You know, I heard the governor and Mr. Schatz there, I guess, talking about, you know, reviewing safety measures and everything. And I don't understand, I guess, what you can really do further. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, the social workers are often dealing with, you know, probably people battling mental illness and drug addiction. And it sounds like they, you know, this one just blew off the handle. And is there any real way that you can prevent that, or is it just kind of the nature of the work?
Jeff, thanks for your call. Let's put that to Gary Widrick, because one of the questions here is about safety. Mm-hmm. We've heard a lot about safety concerns that social workers often have when they're doing field work. Certainly in the case that everybody is thinking about here with Lara Sobel, she was coming out of an office, so she wasn't even on a home visit or a field visit. But what are social workers taught about tense situations, how to protect mm-hmm. themselves, how to de-escalate situations? Mm-hmm. Jeff's right. In some cases, you can't avoid somebody.
Well, as going back to what I said earlier, Jane, there has to be an assessment made when you go into the home or meet the family for the first time of what's going on. And one of those things that comes out is what's going on in terms of violence. Or has there been a previous violence? I mean, from psychological science, we know one of the best predictors of violence is previous violence. Is there easy access to firearms? Have people been threatened? Has this person have a record? And I want to just make one statement here. We don't want to castigate all clients of human services as potential threats. They're not. The vast majority of people I've worked with in my career, spanning over 50 years, are not threats. They're actually very vulnerable themselves to threats from others. But having said that, there are some people who you really have to take seriously. So what we train, and is the training that's being done as far as I know, although I think it certainly could be beefed up, is understanding the threat assessment within the home, both for the child, certainly for what's happening with the child, and that's always paramount. But if there's a threat to the child, there may be threats to others, including the social worker. Certainly if threats have been called in, and if there's a documentation of that, that should be noted, and the social worker should bring that immediately to their supervisor. I had said earlier that one of the best aspects of – and this is borne out by the research I've done with social workers and on the front lines – is that the relationship with their supervisor is so important. That supervisor should, if she or he hears of this, provide the resources and support or protection that's needed. Now, some human service agencies provide what we call CPI trainings, a crisis intervention if somebody goes off and is violent, you know. And, you know, I think that's a standard practice. But basically what we were talking about here was a very severe situation. Now, luckily, that doesn't happen a whole lot across the country based upon the data I've seen. But the threats are constant. That is a real rule of life in social work. We also talk to our social workers about how to care for the self, because social workers see so much and experience so much that they sometimes experience what we call vicarious trauma themselves, and they carry that with them in their bodies. That's a real issue that has to be dealt with in terms of providing for healthy outlet support, paid time, mental health time, et cetera, mental health. Also, I would suggest that almost all social workers, as I did, go to therapy. I mean receive therapy, because there's so much that you take in that's really hard to process. So, but I think a comprehensive safety plan for every – I think what the governor and Commissioner Schatz is talking about, a comprehensive safety plan is necessary, and that has to be reinforced with the resources, as everybody's talking about, and also the knowledge, so that no one goes out on a home visit alone, fearing for their life. You know, that should never happen. And of course, what happened in this tragic situation with Lara, you know, means that the office sometimes is a target. We saw what happened with the Marine. I mean, who would have ever thought that a Marine recruiting station would be attacked? It was. So we have to be prepared, I think, at the state level, federal level, for that, unfortunately, now. And I would have to say, and this is the only personal comment I'll make at this whole thing, there's too many guns around, and there's too many people who have access to guns. And I know it's a hunting state, and everybody likes to hunt, and that's fine. But this isn't about hunting. You know, it's about access to weapons. They're so easy that almost anybody can find them. And in this case, it was tragic. So I just want to put that on the table as well.
Gary, before we have more calls, and I want to get to them. But before we do, you mentioned that that there should be comprehensive safety protocols in place. They should be just across the board, clearly delineated. You've worked with a lot of Vermont social workers. You send students to DCF offices. Do you think DCF has a robust enough safety protocol right now?
I think at one point it probably did, Jane. I think in the new environment that we're living in, after what we saw happen in Tennessee and all of these other places, I think we're at a new level here. I think so every time that changes, we have to bring our training and our standards and our policy up to that level. I think I heard it was the governor or someone saying they were in the process of reviewing their safety protocols. I think that's a good thing. I think
Commissioner Schatz said they were planning. They were already in the process of doing that before this happened.
And I think we have to hold public officials accountable to make sure that happens. Because let's face it, if people feel they're going to be threatened like that on the job, who would want to take a job like that? These jobs are very critical jobs. We need to have people in them doing the work for the children and families of Vermont. And they have to feel secure to the degree that we can. There's no 100% security, but to the degree they can. So I would urge folks to up those protocols as soon as possible.
We're talking about social work today. We're learning a little bit more about what the job entails. And right now we're speaking about the safety concerns that many social workers feel and how they can deal with that, how they're trained to deal with that. If you have questions, if you have experiences you want to share, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Annie says, look, when we talk about safety training in social work and child welfare, we run the risk of implying that the burden of safety lies with the worker rather than with the community at large. I am a social worker in community mental health, and every time I visit a client's home, there are precautions I can take to stay safe. But ultimately, a person with a gun and violent intentions is far more in control of the situation than I am. As a community, we need to take responsibility for the safety of the workers who we are in turn asking to ensure the safety of our most vulnerable citizens. This means taking a hard look in the mirror at the violent society we've fostered rather than simply focusing on more safety trainings for workers. And let's go to Leanne, who's on the line with us from Colchester. Hi, Leanne, go ahead.
Hi. First I wanted to say hi to Gary. I went through the university social work program and found it to be very helpful. What I did find that was sort of minimal at best was thinking about the human service providers who were going out into the community and how to for them to have a sense of safety in creating that so they can do the good work and intervening. Nobody does well feeling stressed and threatened. So, and that really, I didn't get that from my education at the university, though it was very good. I've got that from my current profession, which is a police officer. And I think what's important is that if we talk about training, that we think about how do we help people feel safe in their environment or give them permission not to be in that environment. Mm-hmm. And that's a balancing and a complex issue. But I just wanted to mention that I can't tell you the number of calls I fielded from friends that I graduated with who are looking for, you know, what can you provide training, or is there information out there? Where is that? And I think that that's a really important part of this conversation that has been brought to light by a really tragic situation. So that's all I wanted to say.
Thanks, Leanne. Gary?
Leanne, thanks. That's, you know, what you've said is all true. And I think what it means is that we have to, at the university as well, take a look at how we're providing within the curriculum that type of information. We do talk a lot about how social workers should take care of themselves and how self-care is so important. But certainly safety is a huge aspect of self-care. If you do not feel safe in your job, if you go in every day worrying that someone's waiting for you or whatever, that's certainly going to impact upon your effectiveness and your proficiency in the job. So it's a critical factor. I agree with you. And I think we all need to take this seriously. And that's why I said we all have to be held accountable to make sure this happens.
We got a note from Sean who says, being forced to, quote, work together with a state agency isn't what most parents are looking for when they have a child. I think it's important that Gary acknowledges that the work he does is invasive for families and is often, understandably, met with resistance. The pretext for an initial visit from DCF is that a family member, neighbor, or someone else close to the family has judged and reported your parenting as unfavorable and possibly neglectful. So you've talked a little bit, Gary, about the trust that a social worker needs to develop with a family. And, you know, Sean is saying that's really hard if what you're coming in as is an adversary, because that's the situation that's been set up.
That's true. And most of the clients we work with in child welfare, what we call involuntary clients. In other words, they're not choosing to seek help or to seek services. Someone has asked that services be provided. And once again, social workers are responding to the law as it's written by the legislature. They're responding to family court dictums, to case plans that have been developed by a group of people. So it's not just the social workers who are saying, well, let's go out into that home and try to find out what's going on in that family. Now, I think we all understand the issue around privacy and the freedom that people should have to be able to raise their children within limits, obviously. And if abuse or neglect are happening, the state everybody has agreed, and you know, across this country, across the so-called developed country, there state intervention and you can look at this up. State intervention is the norm because we have concerns that parents cannot, and actually Hillary Clinton wrote a whole treatise on this around children's rights. Children have rights. They have rights to be protected and safe in their own bodies. And so, you know, the state has to intervene within some circumstances, but overly invasive, no. We don't want to go into situations. That's why many of these reports, by the way, your listeners, Jane, should know this. Most of the reports are not substantiated, you know. But they are reported, and under the new, especially the new laws that are coming out around mandated reporting and everything, they have to be followed up on to be determined whether they are valid or not.
Gary, we got a note from a listener who says, while I know that the workers at DCF have an unbelievably difficult job, I have experienced incredibly unprofessional behavior and behavior that's completely lacking in compassion. I feel like DCF operates like something out of Kafka, with not nearly enough oversight and not nearly enough accountability. Inexperienced and not adequately trained people are given the power to make decisions over family units that will forever alter the way these family units exist or cease to exist. There is little or no recourse for the families involved in a system that is already overburdened and inadequately staffed. So that's the note from our listener. And you had mentioned right at the beginning of the show, Gary, that one of the ways the department at UVM has operated is with a federal grant that was initiated because there was not enough good training, it sounds like, and that the government was worried about the way states were operating these child welfare systems. So it sounds like, you know, there is some concern that in some cases it's not being operated well.
Yeah, there's certainly valid concerns out there. And I recently was involved in a 10-year project in the Abenaki community in which the whole community up there was very upset and angry. And we do know that there's been disproportionate placements of children out of home among minority communities, Native Americans, African Americans, Hispanic. So we do know that there are some problems and some issues there. But one of the areas that I see that could be fruitful would be to develop – and we developed a community advisory board in which we had representatives from the community and also from DCF and from the university work together and plan out how to provide services. And I think this is, once again, my own professional view over 50 years. The closer services are to the community and the more accountable they are to the community, the more things will fall into place. And that's not going to solve every problem we have. And many people, just like your previous caller, are upset that social workers even go into the home hardly at all. But my sense is that the more people understand what social work is doing, it's like the community cop on the beat. When the cop gets out of the car and starts interacting with people in their community rather than staying in their vehicle or their, you know, their assault vehicle or whatever, people tend to get to know them and understand what the work is. My sense is some of this is problems in communication and understanding, and also understanding what the mandate that social workers have to work under. Remember, once again, the mandate is not set by social workers. It's set by the federal government, the state government, and the courts. So we have to know that all of this is part of our democratic system in which we operate.
Gary, do you think people will be dissuaded from going into social work, looking at what kind of scrutiny the profession has had lately, and then certainly an issue like this that's tragic and has ripple effects?
Well, Jane, that's an interesting question. I've talked to so many applicants that have come into our program, both at the undergraduate and the graduate level. And I'll tell you this, and I mentioned this earlier, I think. This is a calling. Social work is a calling. It's like the Peace Corps. People come into it because they're humanitarians and they really want to work with people and they really believe in the change, that change can come about, and that they want not to change people themselves, but they want to work together to support people in changing, making the changes that they want in their own lives. It's a real humanitarian profession. I don't think, as bad as this tragedy was, and it was horrible and senseless and it should never happen again, I don't think this is going to deter people from going into the profession. I hope not, because we need social workers and we need people who care and we need people who are not in it for the money. I want to make an emphasis. This is one of the lowest paid professions that we could possibly have, but they're in it because they want to help people change.
Gary Widrick is the former chair of the social work department at the University of Vermont, and he's former director of the grant that gives students training for work in child welfare. Gary, thank you very much for your insight today.
Thank you, Jane.
Coming up, Keurig Green Mountain has had a rough few months. We'll hear from an industry analyst what he thinks might be dampening the future of the Vermont coffee giant. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, Keurig Green Mountain announced it would lay off 330 workers after a disappointing third quarter report. 200 of those layoffs are here in Vermont, where the publicly traded corporation was founded 34 years ago as Green Mountain Coffee Roasters. Keurig Green Mountain has had explosive growth for many years as it took over the single-serve coffee market with its K-Cup coffee pods and Keurig brewing machines. But the company has faltered recently. One industry observer who has watched Keurig Green Mountain closely is Seth Golden, an analyst with Capital Ladders, and he joins us now. Seth, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me today.
All right, so here's the upshot of the third quarter report. Keurig's pod sales are down. The brewer and accessory sales also down. The second generation Keurig 2.0 brewer has not sold well because it has some restrictive and proprietary features on the machine, and it's a fairly high price point, and consumers are not responding well to it. So it could look like Keurig Green Mountain is a company in decline, and you say it might be, but not necessarily for those reasons. Can you start by telling me the good news, why you say those stats aren't actually as bad as they look?
Well, there's various segments to the Keurig Green Mountain business. As you mentioned, there's the brewer side of the business and the K-Cup side of the business. And then those two segments are also segmented once again between the at-home business and the commercial business, or the away-from-home business. And when you look at the results on the surface, they do seem rather poor, and they have been poor for several quarters now. However, digging deeper into the most recent quarterly report, you come to find that the away-from-home business segment had a very tough comparison versus the year ago, and management did point that out on the conference call for investors and analysts. The only thing that they didn't do is really detail, why the away-from-home business performed so poorly during the quarter versus the same period year ago. The biggest outlier in the quarter with that business segment was that Subway and Hilton Hotels both began their relationship with Keurig Green Mountain products during the third quarter of 2014. So the company had to essentially, you know, try to comp to that big pipeline build into those major companies, and they weren't able to do so. If we were just discussing the at-home business segment, the K-Cups were actually up year over year. So, you know, the investors really have to consider all the detail, you know, in the quarterly report and understand the year-over-year comparison to get a really good perspective on what's going on.
So it's almost like Keurig Green Mountain could never really have matched last year's big contracts with Hilton Hotels and Subway. And so it's not really that they're down so much this year. It's just a comparison to last year that's going to look so negative. But Seth Golden, you still think the company could be in trouble. And you pinpoint one really key tension point here for Keurig Green Mountain, and that's their cold system. And I say cold with a K. Why is that such a problem? Right.
Well, there's really no place for it in the market. Essentially, Keurig believes that the Keurig cold system should, over time, perform as well, if not better, than the hot platforms, the Keurig brewers as we know them today. But there's a big difference in delivering a cold beverage through a small appliance and a hot beverage through a small appliance. If I want a hot cup of coffee, I really don't have much choice. Either I have to go out to a Dunkin' Donuts or a Starbucks or whatever, or I have to have a coffee brewer. I can't just reach into the refrigerator and pull out a hot cup of coffee. With a cold beverage, I can. I don't need a brewer. The consumer does not need a brewer. So that's the biggest reason why I think the company is misunderstanding, you know, how this product could perform. The second problem with it is the pricing that they've unveiled for the Keurig cold system. The small appliance, the Keurig cold brewer, will be at a base price of $299, upwards of $369. And the pods, each individual pod, will be on average $1.14. So never before in American history, at least, has there been a small appliance priced over $149 that has reached mass market adoption. And that's essentially what it needs to reach to do as well as the hot Keurig brewer system has done. So every which way you analyze that product line, you hit a brick wall. So it really begs to question the amount of research they've done with this product and with this particular category, the cold, and some of the decisions that the company has made with investor money.
Well, and we should point out the cold system hasn't yet come onto retail shelves. People are going to be looking for that,
correct,
I think, at the end of the year, right before the holiday season and maybe slightly afterwards. Seth, you know, you say, look, people can just open their fridge door and get a cold beverage that is also, by the way, probably cheaper than what they would get, yes, if they bought a cold system from Keurig. And you see no reason for this. There's no problem that Keurig is solving,
yes,
for the consumer.
Not solving any problem.
So,
correct. It's not solving any problem whatsoever.
So why do you think Keurig Green Mountain made what you see as such a big blunder in figuring out what people might want?
I think in the beginning, they saw the window of opportunity that presented itself in the category by SodaStream, which is the global leader in that particular category that's known as home carbonation. So they saw the opportunity, but they thought that they could deliver a greater convenience. With SodaStream, you have to refill your CO2 cylinder. So Keurig Green Mountain said, hey, we can invent a technology, or we can utilize technology that already exists to eliminate the quote-unquote hassle of bringing your CO2 cylinder to a store and have it refilled. So they thought that there was a convenience factor that they could capitalize on for this category. However, as they went along the product development cycle, they realized that there were there were variables that were beyond their control, yet they had already dedicated far too much capital to turn back. And at this point, with the brand partnerships from Dr. Pepper and Coca-Cola on the platform, they have to essentially go through with it. At least that's how it seems to be portrayed to the public at this point.
Seth, we don't have a lot of time left, but in just a couple of seconds, it sounds like you also don't think much of Keurig Green Mountain's leadership.
There's just too many missteps ever since the new CEO has come aboard, Brian Kelly. Everything has failed, whether it was the View hot brewer system, the Revo espresso maker that was a co-product development with Luigi Lavazza, and now the Keurig 2.0 and the future Keurig Cold. Nothing seems to work, and it seems as if they just continue to backpedal, and the results are there for everyone to see, unfortunately, their poor results.
That's Seth Golden. He's an analyst with Capital Ladders. We've been getting his perspective on issues facing Keurig Green Mountain, the corporation formerly known as Green Mountain Coffee Roasters. Seth, thank you very much for your perspective.
Thank you kindly. Have a great day.
And that'll do it for today's show. Over the past few weeks, a national news story has been unfolding about Planned Parenthood and how the organization handles fetal tissue after abortions. The controversy emerged after an anti-abortion organization released edited undercover videotape of Planned Parenthood officials discussing the practice. Tomorrow on the show, we'll look at how this national story does and doesn't relate to the funding and services that Planned Parenthood provides in our region. You can send your questions to Vermont Edition at vpr.org. And join us for that discussion tomorrow. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.